Hello.
It's good to talk to you. We're coming now to the part of this odd semester of ours in which it's my task to try and sum over where we have been in the last 10 weeks and to afford some clarity, if clarity is what one can afford in these unclear times of ours, with respect to what the issues are that will dominate the relation between the state and its citizens over the next several decades of your working life. The task is one in which I feel at one and the same time that I have prepared us well for this occasion, and also that I have prepared us even more poorly than usual. By the time I come to the end of this two-course sequence every spring, I am aware of the depth of the problems and also of the difficulty of bringing an analysis to the point at which it offers something that might be called solutions, but this year I feel that gap even more clearly, or at least even more poignantly than I usually do. We have attempted both to understand something about the constitutional history of the United States federal constitution in its relation to the current technical challenges of the networked society, and at the same time to look a little bit beyond the particular American U.S.-centric terms in which that history has been lived out and those issues are currently being raised, in order to see what the broader implications are for any conception of ordered liberty in which the state guarantees rights to its citizens and takes on duties to protect and preserve those rights, while at the same time being, as it inevitably is, an instrument of power enormously increased in its weight and potential oppressiveness by the nature of the technologies before us. When I started teaching this course in 1997, it was, I think, still possible to conceive, and I was still perhaps possibly the sort of person who would conceive, of the 21st century technologies of networked interaction as bringing about what my friend Karl Marx might call the withering away of the state. The potential liberating qualities of the networks powers, its ability to make it possible for every brain on earth to learn whatever it wants to learn without regard to the ability to pay or the whims of government, the difficulty of maintaining in a network in which people possess their own communication security, the taboos, whether political or cultural, which have been the central rituals of the maintenance of power by the few over the many for the last 40,000 years or so, the enormous capability pushed to the edge of the net and thereby resting in the hands of people, children and grown-ups and children in particular, all seemed to suggest that we might actually be achieving what not only I, but many of my contemporaries who wanted to be part of a movement for radical human liberation through digital technology were conceiving and hoping for and in some early ways implementing, and at least with respect to the kind of legal work I did on behalf of the free software movement, trying to embed in law. I suppose that the point of inflection occurred in the fall of 2001, while I was on leave, still mourning my father's death. By the time I came back to teach this course for the first time after that leave in the spring of 2002. I had collected several thousand pieces of journalism and coverage about the Patriot Act and the what little could be seen of the post-September 11th efforts by the United States to build more surveillance into society. But in the long run, of course, as we have seen both last semester and in this term's discussion, what primarily happened wasn't just that the state refused to wither away, that on the basis of the prevention of terrorism, the state entrenched itself, not just this state, but even this state, more deeply into the surveillance of human behavior than it had been in the past, but all the more importantly, that the forms of capitalism accelerated by the shift to networked communication and networked life, the rise of the platform companies, and the adoption by a large proportion of the human race of the forms of digital communication, which not only didn't increase their freedom vis-a-vis the listeners, but massively increased their exposure to government listening and control through the expansion of private power based around behavior collection and monetization through advertising. All those institutions that grew up not only immediately in the first decade of the 21st century, but far more powerfully in the second decade of the 20th century, have left the idea of the withering away of the state just as far off as it was after the publication of the Communist Manifesto in 1867. Instead, as we look out past the end of the global epidemic in the year 2021, we see increasingly what the President of the United States has defined as a competition between democracy and autocracy for the control of the majority of the population of the human race in the later part of the 21st century, where autocracy has been very clearly redefined, primarily through the rising economic and political might of the Chinese Communist Party in its control of the People's Republic of China, as perfected despotism, that is to say, the use of the network to install everywhere behavior collection of a prevailing and comprehensive kind, put to the business of automated social control through the systems of pattern recognition and nudging in the ordinary facts of daily life through discretionary control of the payment systems and collection of all the data about human movements and etc., which will allow government to exert levels of control over individual human lives that in the 20th century were called totalitarianism, but with a very much reduced unit cost and reliance upon automated systems rather than the doing of the work of thuggery by thugs in order to extinguish what we have thought of heretofore as human freedom. The question that arises if one sees the world in that bipolar fashion, which perhaps is not in fact the best of all possible views, but if one sees the world as Joe Biden would have us see it now, then the great problem is that democracy has not yet arrived at the theory of its relationship to the network's power of behavior collection, that extraskeletal nervous system embracing all of humanity with anything like the clarity with which autocracy has expressed itself in Chinese. So, in a form of inquiry in which, as I have tediously over-suggested to you, we are always engaged both in understanding and in constructing measures for the domestication of the network, the retention of humane values in the world of the new superorganismic form of humanity, the one in which we have developed all that extraskeletal nervous system processing and collection power, in laying out what has happened and in talking about what ought or will happen, we are always dependent upon three understandings braided together: technological understandings of what is occurring and what can occur in the physiology of this anatomy we have built for the nervous system collecting the species. The law, with which, as lawyers, we are preferentially inclined to and perhaps educated to deal, and the politics, that is to say, the conceptions and machinery with which we allocate power in society and justify the measures that power takes. As I have tried to stress, particularly in relation to the future of the First Amendment, the evolution of our political theory, a theory of informational democracy, a theory about how the people can rule when information is the primary source of power, that's the most difficult piece to understand in the triad of understandings out of which we are both trying to constitute our view of the present and evolve a normative conception of the future that we want. Constitutional law, that is, the relationship between citizens and the state, and in particular the form of constitutional law that protects individual rights as expressed in the Bill of Rights of the United States Constitution, is our central focus. This is law school. And so we have gone from Part 4 to Part 1 and Part 6 and are now standing on the lines in the sidewalk that rule out the square I call Parts 9 and 14, because the Bill of Rights and its individual provisions is the navigational instruction, the map for us as lawyers. And what I have been laboring to show over the course of this term is that the theory of a government of limit powers wielding an imperial authority, an army broad enough to possess the continent and yet sufficiently restrained as not to inherently destroy self-government among people, that was the problem understood by the late 18th century, and its devices bequeathed to us down the centuries have in the 20th century taken on certain forms that we can think of as the modern First and Fourth Amendments, and the understanding of individual rights protected by the rule of law that have been adumbrated over the last two lifetimes by the United States Supreme Court. But in placing the law at the center of the inquiry, and thereby obliging us to think about its history, the nature of the process by which we came to understand rights and their defense in the particular ways in which we understood them, we have also bound ourselves more tightly to the effort to understand how technology alone has modified those understandings so rapidly that the law has difficulty catching up. The purpose of beginning with the tragedy of the Fourth Amendment is to show why that which was solid melting into air between the 18th and the 21st centuries fundamentally altered what it takes in order to control the state's investigative power. In reading and editing the first draft of your first essays, I have, of course, encountered yet again the intensity of everybody's desire to wave a wand and to produce a Fourth Amendment that works. by dealing with what we have all collaborated to call the third-party problem, but which might otherwise be described as the mother of all waivers. The principle that in order to protect the right of the people to be secure in their persons, houses, papers, and effects, the people themselves have to do something to protect their persons, houses, papers, and effects, is not an accidental doctrine of the Fourth Amendment or a mistake made by the Supreme Court in this case or that case, which can be altered by the decision of the Supreme Court in a different case. The hopefulness with which you have in various of your drafts simply announced that third-party doctrine has to be modified because, like the unease that began to strike Justice Sotomayor in particular in the middle of this decade, a recognition that the machinery is off the rails, or rather that new rails have been constructed and the machinery can't run on it, that I have described as tragedy because it isn't just a thing that you can do by wishing that you were back in Kansas. It won't go like that. The technological possibility that we can restore something like our intended Fourth Amendment rights, on the other hand, though I have labored wherever possible to indicate its vitality, does not appeal to you. I'm speaking now collectively about you as in your role as essay writers. We can understand, in a sense, why. Facebook has always told its investors that it was an unendingly superb thing to buy into because it was a roach motel, and that the population of the world, the human population of the world, at any rate, not the roach population of the world, could enter it but never leave, because once it is there and all its friends are there and all its family is there, etc., etc., it can't stop being there. This was never a correct technological proposition, however. It depended not upon the technological network effects, but rather upon the psychological network effects. That is, the tendency of something that seems very convenient to absorb all of the desire for innovation, thus neutering it and leaving everybody stuck to the platform. That same effect, the psychological network effect of giving up everything to an entity that manages it for you and calling that convenient, is, after all, the fundamentally transformative force in making despotism easier. The theory of the Fourth Amendment, as I tried to show over the weeks we spent on its history, the theory of the Fourth Amendment is that thuggery by government is difficult because expensive and hard to conduct at scale. And if, given the limitations of power in a U.S. federal government, that system of investigative thuggery, which is necessary to render the people truly insecure in their persons, houses, papers, and effects, can be made less doable if the scaling up of thuggery can be substantially prevented, and if, in the end, juries and other community-based institutions legally control those activities, then the growth of empire, the ability to possess the North American continent, the sufficiency of force to subdue foreign interference and indigenous campaigning for the autonomy of the native people, if all of that can be dealt with on a scale which does not allow every constable and every busybody in society to become a resource for thuggery, then freedom of people can be maintained. But in the condition of our society, if people decide voluntarily to put photographs of all their papers and the interiors of their houses are equipped with cameras and microphones, and if every communication that they might have committed to paper or to a quiet personal whisper is instead being conducted through the servers of third parties who take it and turn a profit on it, then thuggery is easily scaled to a wholesale level. And once the collection of everybody's behavior has become the goal of the wealthiest businesses in the world, then the simplicity of government's relation to all that information is much enhanced. Instead of getting it from your house and from the papers in your drawer, they have only to ask Mountain View, and they will have it. The transformation of the process of search from the entering of places and the eyeballing of things by people who have warrant to the process of asking those who already possess everything to hand a particular slice of it to the government under principles of investigative power that are limited only by the notional importance of the rule of law. What does it really matter in that sense whether probable cause is shown to a magistrate or a subpoena blank is filled out by a prosecutor and in due course stamped? How does it really make a difference in a world of instantaneous communication, fully understood, or at most of the time at least fully registered as to the endpoints, by powerful businesses making so much money out of it that they can afford to slow the government slightly down by raising objections or imposing conditions on the fulfillment of subpoena requests? How do we restore the sense of the individual at the center of the process of determining what government is allowed to learn? And although the Fourth Amendment is in itself linguistically drawn in such a way as to make our effort more difficult by its profound insistence upon places and things, by its determination that the political economy of thuggery can be constrained by limitations on the issuance of warrants requiring other officials of government to serve the immediate needs of the national security or police powers. And yet, the principle that has been handed down to us and which we feel culturally in our bones, the sanctity of where we live, the requirement that government do more than knock with fists or batons on the door, that it must have secured some significant degree of community or professional acceptance of what it is doing before it can proceed, weak as that may be against the background of the history of the tyranny of modern societies, still we hold very firmly to it. And if we were determined to assist ourselves technologically in the maintenance of our rights, there is much that we can do. In essence, of course, as I said as far back as 2006, this really has to do with storing it ourselves. Our data belongs in our houses, like our papers and effects. not in a bin on the street where even the California Supreme Court might have a hard time proving that we can compel the state to get a warrant before looking at what we have voluntarily laid out on the sidewalk. Not in the places where 20th century experience taught us that the state has every reason to expect its power over regulated industries like banks and insurance companies to do the work for it of making keeping public order simpler. And for all the reasons that the network is so flexible at putting everything everywhere else, it can be equally flexible and sophisticated at putting everything under your bed. Surely it is right to recognize that our constitutional history teaches us that if eternal vigilance is the price of liberty, then the price of an external hard drive attached to a little box plugged into the wall under the bed is not too much to pay. But we are lawyers, and so we don't like hearing that it's actually just boxes and programmers that make the difference, and indeed they're not enough all by themselves. Still, the primary lesson of the Fourth Amendment for us is that we structure everything in society to make government of the people, by the people, for the people possible, or we lose it, and it perishes from the earth. It's not going to be magically restored by 5 votes on the Supreme Court turning the Fourth Amendment into a general privacy law. And general privacy law, whatever it can do, is not particularly good, as legislators are not particularly good, at turning down the overwhelming political power of the protective force of government when people are afraid. So civil defense, in the Swiss or Austrian sense, everybody should be able to defend their homes. Everybody should be able to hold out for some period of time against tyrannical invasion. Civil defense of our rights is part of our constitutional tradition, and it is part of our constitutional future if we are to have any. This is why in the Snowden Lectures I pointed out that there are really 2 histories of constitutional rights in the United States. The official history of the politically empowered, which in our badly configured history means white people's rights, and the protection of rights that could only exist through the organization of civil resistance, because our rights were taken to be entirely compatible with the existence of chattel slavery. And thus we arrived at a constitutional tradition which is as deeply based around Frederick Douglass as it is around Abraham Lincoln. And in this sense of the people having to protect their own rights, whether it is the myth of 1776 or the reality of slave efforts at community building, community resistance, and the community celebration of the dignity and freedom of all human beings, we have ourselves a long and deep connection to the idea that if we are to be free, we must do it ourselves. With respect to the 18th century view of the importance of the militia against the professional army and the rather convoluted reading of that, which has produced for us a constitutional right to 400 million handguns in a country of 340 million people, this has apparently become a second nature belief in a large part of the society. But it doesn't do us much good because it's only about the gun, it's not about the freedom box. That, too, has become part of the consumer basis of societal understanding. If you buy a gun, you're free. Whereas, of course, the real point is, as John Adams said to Thomas Jefferson in a letter of the long after both had left politics forever, the revolution occurred first in the minds of men. Or as Ralph Waldo Emerson put it, all revolutions begin first in one man's mind, a slogan which used to be painted up on the small office of the Red Hat Software Company in Raleigh, North Carolina, and in which I suppose the one man's mind in whom the revolution had occurred is my now disowned and canceled comrade, client, colleague, and friend Richard Stallman. But the revolution that must occur to make the security of the people in their persons, houses, papers, and effects real in the 21st century is not occurring in one person's mind. It's occurring in the foundries where the chips are made, in the factories where the hard drives and the SSDs are assembled. We can have freedom with infrastructure for freedom, or we can have no security in our persons, houses, papers, and effects because we built instead an infrastructure for efficient collection of everything and reduction of the costs of thuggery near zero. In that sense, then, the tragedy of the Fourth Amendment is, from my point of view, the invitation to the comedy of freedom box. To invert this nervous system which has been built around us from the entities collect everything, government deals with those entities for anything it wants structure of the physiology of our shared nervous system, to one which says government has an obligation to assist people, all people, everywhere, to protect the persons, houses, papers, and effects of themselves and those they love against unreasonable searches and seizures by reasonable efforts to maintain their privacy. Those who compromise their long-term freedom for a little short-term security will, as Benjamin Franklin observes, get neither. And those who are prepared to take the lessening of convenience for the benefit of freedom will discover that they get both. Technological solutions don't, in fact, however, assure the civic freedom that we depend upon with respect to our security in persons, houses, papers, and effects, because the technology merely allows us to withstand assault better. But it is in our politics, in our understanding of informational democracy, our recognition that if information is power and power is to continue to belong to the people, then the people must possess the power to govern information, which is the central step to which everything must lead. We need a revolution in our political thinking, in our minds, like the one that Thomas Jefferson and John Adams lived through and which gave birth to our republic, to a change in emphasis, in understanding, from that of parliamentary supremacy and the military power of the king as commander-in-chief to a system of federal localisms governed by juries and local magistrates empowered to protect the liberty of the people to choose their government and to be protected against the excesses of the greedy will to power. The interaction between politics and constitutional law is so intimate and so interpenetrated that, at least for those of us of a realist disposition, it's hard to speak of constitutional law and politics as in any way different forms, but they are, because of their different relationship to time. Constitutional law, even where constitutions are newer than those of the United States, constitutional law is inherently backward-looking. It attempts to observe and to instantiate, well, as Holmes calls it, the traditions of our people and our law. But our constitutional politics is forward-looking, deals with the next election and everything beyond it. And to constitute a constitutional revolution, our politics must first have changed in ways that allow us to update, with continuity preserved, our traditional understandings about government and its relationship to people, as that relationship itself is altered in fast-moving times. In breaching the comedy of the First Amendment after the tragedy of the Fourth, I am, of course, attempting to show how informational democracy can grow in a consistent way out of at least our understanding of the people's rights of communication and assembly and the free exercise of their beliefs as the 20th century erected those conceptions. The movement from the First Amendment of the era of mass press and broadcasting to the era of the infinitely particularizable and infinitely surveillable net is a deeply complex one, but it doesn't bear that quality of we have to somehow escape all the words in order to play all the music problem which the Fourth Amendment presents. This doesn't reduce complexity, it increases it. Our understanding that the informational environment of the 20th century was a creation of government. Government had to decide what to do about the electromagnetic spectrum, and in doing so, it altered all the other forms of mass and semi-mass communication that we called the press, after the machine that first brought about the kinds of communication we are discussing. The First Amendment's quality as a test of government's ability to do what must be done to structure the forms of communication that govern society in the fullest, most post-political sense. The effort to ensure that we understand that all around us in our environment of communications, the semiotics of society, we are seeing not something that grew up outside government but alongside and inside government, raises the inevitability that government will ultimately have to structure what comes next, and that the principles handed down from the 18th century and implemented in the 20th to produce the mass media society we called democracy now require us to structure democracy in the world of the net in new ways. If we are going to bring what are still called broadband connections to the whole of the U.S. population, which is part of the infrastructure of society as the current administration now defines it, the idea that we are going to bring that broadband everywhere and then simply say, and it's up to the private parties to determine how surveilled that network will be or how free people will be to express themselves within it without having all their reading monitored is simply not credible. In the end, it's government which makes all of that happen, and which therefore must set the principles within which it happens on the basis of whatever it is that we are calling democracy at the time. Over the long run, we will be glad for the tone deafness and the political ineptitude of the platform companies which first raised the new forms of the social life of the network around us. They were so inherently committed to expanding their power cancerously, growing without restraint and without regard for the physiological harm done to other forces, what they called disruption. If cancer had a motto, it would be, move fast and break things, wouldn't it? And in that form of unregulated, temporarily unlimited growth, they did the profound favor to all of us of raising within years the inflammatory immunological mechanisms in the human race that demanded something. What will be demanded in the near term will be interventions designed to disrupt the disruptors. And as I suggested last time, this will have the effect of producing over the next 10 to 15 years a bunch of disrupt the disruptors legislation, not only in the United States but elsewhere in the democratic world. And that legislation will then have to be squared against the existing halfway house of constitutional principle, partly the problems of the new, partly the doctrines of the old, with the inevitable consequence that over the course of time, the judges will find themselves in their encounters between disrupted disruptors legislation and long-term principles, changing the principle. That will occur sometimes with no larger intention than the decision of today's case. Indeed, as we know, our principles of constitutional restraint, the most important thing we do is not doing Ashwanderism in our law, in our constitutional law in particular, will mean that the common law-ish evolution of our new principles in relation to our new legislation will lack vision. It will decide today's case in a new way, but the novelty of that decision will be limited to the circumstances or the contexts in which the decisions are made. But by 10 or 15 years from now, that process will inevitably have brought about in the courts, in the court, in the academy, and even in more far-flung places, it will have brought about a bigger vision of what it means to talk about democracy in the second information age. And in that process, the particulars of our technology will make a difference. Facebook exists because we made browsers easy, and everybody could read things scattered about the net in a deeply sensible and comprehensive way, partly the hypertext invented by Ted Nelson and partly the form of hypertext invented by Tim Berners-Lee. When we built browsers and put them in everything and made it possible for everybody to read everything everywhere, what we did not do was make it easy for every human being to run a web server. And so these forms of degenerate little web servers, Facebook pages and Instagram live stories and timelines on Twitter and the Google Pluses, oh, minus, whatever Google Plus used to be that's minus now, all these forms of services, inherently capable of federation but actually centralized, of negligible cost but offered free in return for the bonanza of all human behavior information. All this technologically crap design that undermines freedom can be readily replaced. Whether 45-year-olds want to or 65-year-olds want to, 12-year-olds will. And what we primarily need in that sense, as we need in so many other ways, in so many other forms in society, is civic education. Many of you have pointed that out in your essays, and you're quite right. But civic education in the New Republic, as my dear late colleague Robert Ferguson pointed out, was the work of lawyers. Law and literature in the American Republic is basically Ferguson's way of pointing out that for the first part of the life of the American Republic, from foundation through the Civil War, it was lawyers who were the primary writers and conductors of the civic education of the society. And it didn't die when Booth shot Lincoln either. In other words, the law, not only being the moral residue of all our ages, as Holmes would say, is also the textbook of our freedoms in the future. And it's in that dialogue of evolving law between the legislators' increasing desire to control the platform companies and the judges' requirements to understand how the control of the platform companies can be squared with constitutional rights at time T1, that brings us to time T2, where our attitudes have changed, and what we teach in the schools has changed, and what we use the Raspberry Pis for has changed. Those of you who are beginning to experiment with freedom boxes, I salute you. But it doesn't really matter whether it's this software or some other software. The physiology of the net can change with the anatomy of the net. We can move to smaller scale and more self-reliance with the result that we are more a self-reliant people and therefore have more rights. That's Jeffersonian in its understanding. Radicalized by that part of the constitutional tradition that Massa-Tom could not reach, precisely because he was Massa-Tom. And far more dependent upon our ability to master the technology of the server than the technology of the firearm. The legal tragedy is a political opportunity and a technological opening. The First Amendment's immense power over the state, its absolute limitations upon exercises of the legislative power, contains within it, as I labored to show, also a power over the state, constructive in nature. as the state's intervention, particularly the federal intervention in the systems of communication and the state government's power to regulate the utilities that lie within its borders, as those forms of government authority are inherently invoked to go through the process of the reshaping of our communications to the new nervous system, the First Amendment will in the end require government to face as it faced in the litigation over the fairness doctrine that led to Red Lion Broadcasting. The state will face the question, if we're going to make it, what obligation do we have to make it in a democratic way, such that no law abridges freedom of speech or of the press? The lawyers who know the technology and who inform the politics by civic education will also be the lawyers who write the laws and litigate the cases that will, across the entirety of our social life, our healthcare, our education, our financial system, and all the rest, including our law enforcement and national security apparatus, the lawyers who make the laws, who conduct the public education, and who litigate the cases will be, in the end, as they were at the beginning of the American Republic, the most important parties. We are here in law school, not just in American law school, but in law school for the world, not just in our building on the Upper West Side, where we barely are, but in all the isolation booths in which we live from one corner of the globe to another. We are watching and speculating and trying to peer through the mist at what is actually among the most important of the categories of the work of our lives to come. Well, not me. My life to come is fairly short, and its annals are likely to be simple, as Gray says in the elegy. Your lives will be long, compared to mine for sure, maybe compared to all the human beings who have previously lived. And the challenges to your freedom will be considerable. In the same way that it is valuable to have the platform companies, in their heedless determination at growth, to remind us of the real power of government and its obligations, the clarity and focus of the Chinese Communist Party upon the control of its and its society's future by the relentless collection and control of everybody is also, well, a silver lining in quite a dark cloud, let us say. We know what the alternative is better than we know our own. Let us say again. And in that process of understanding what the alternative is, we will find the motivation in which we nurture our resistance. Democracy must resist autocracy, not at boundaries, not using warfare only. Let us hope not much at all. Democracy must resist autocracy by providing the infrastructures and technologies of freedom, embedding them in the democratic societies and proving their worth everywhere to create resistance within autocracies and to equip that resistance to achieve humane values in the midst of inhumane management and control. But we need all the stories to do that. The stories of technology's present and immediate future and the stories of constitutional laws present and long past caught up in the inherently forward-looking narrative of informational democracy and the meaning of self-government in the society where information is power. All those stories weave together are what we will be using in order to make things happen in society using words about these freedoms in our time. It's hard without a program. It's hard without the conventions of drama. When should the chorus speak? When are the clowns on stage? When does the hero die? And how does his death transfigure the meaning for those of us who live? We haven't yet a script. Law is often a form of the script, but it is behind now. And everybody feels both its importance and its inadequacy simultaneously. So that's the final job of summing up, to have a program. A program that runs in a little box. A program that makes a campaign of litigation. A program that explains what legislatures can do. But more than anything else, a program which presents the new meaning of the society in its new democratic form. In the fall of 1863, in 272 words, at the newly made Gettysburg National Cemetery, with all the graves still open and the bodies being moved into a rational order, soldiers lying with the others of their states in careful but somewhat macabre array, Abraham Lincoln explained the new meaning of the Democratic Republic of the United States, gave a new vision of what it was that the war that all had been fighting for, well, 2.5 long years already meant, and committed not himself, not themselves, but us, still the living, as he says, to a new birth of freedom. If only I knew how to do it in 272 words, or even in 12 weeks of undisciplined talk. But down to the wire as we are, let's try. Talk to you, sir.